Thank you for joining us for our panel today. My name is Gwen Panyasaile. I'm the Senior Youth Organizer at the Mingkwon Center for Community Action, and I'll be moderating today. So our panel today is From Campus to Community, Strengthening Our Political Power Through Student Voter Empowerment. We have some really lovely panelists for y'all, all really great community workers. I'll give them a second to introduce themselves. And we have a cute little check-in question for them today. So hello, panelists. I'm going to have y'all introduce yourselves one by one with your name, pronouns, organization, and your go-to coffee or boba order.
My name is Angela. I use she, her pronouns. I'm the president of Vote City in the character. Currently, my go-to coffee order is black syrup coffee.
Well, first of all, good morning, everyone. My name is Rabia. My pronouns are she, her. I'm a fellow with Muslim Community Network, and my go-to boba order is the most simplest one, just the regular milk tea, extra boba.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Helen. She, they pronouns. I work at Asian Americans for Equality, and my go-to boba order is jasmine milk tea.
Thanks, everybody. So we're going to jump right into the questions, and then we'll have some time at the end for Q&A. And our first question is, when did you all first vote? What did it feel like? And what compelled you to go out and vote at that age? Does anyone want to give us a start? I think we can just have like a very free-flowing conversation.
I'd love to start, and I also want to start with more of my background. I was born and raised in Queens, the world's borough, Jackson Heights initially, and then I've been in Flushing for over 13 years. I went to private Islamic schools until I attended CUNY for college, John Jay specifically. During high school, Muslim Community Network came, and they introduced me to civic engagement. That was my first introduction to civic engagement, and it led me to be in a position where I was able to host a town hall that was attended by the Queens District Attorney and the public advocate and assembly member. And during college, I ended up, you know, working with my local state senator and judges with the Queens Supreme Court and federal prosecutors. So civic engagement was my community. It was whether you were a lawyer or, a civic organizer or someone in the political space or scholar. Voting was something that you had a community that did the same exact thing, right? So that was kind of your accountability structure. And I don't know if anyone else is like this, but I do keep like a mental note of how many elections I've won versus lost. Like, what did I get right and what did I get wrong? So the presidential election 2020 was my first ever election. And it was, again, my environment, my school, Muslim Community Network, all the passions that I had about public service that kind of held me accountable to be an active member in my community.
It's been a while since my first voting, when I think about that question, I just think about like how in fifth grade when it was between Obama's first term and Hillary, I remember sitting in the classroom hallways crying that Hillary had lost. And all that to share is that I think I've come a long way in terms of like my civic engagement. I first started voting around like 2018 local elections. It felt a little bit disconnected just because I was attending school in California. I didn't really get involved in my community work and doing the community. I actually came back to New York and realized the importance of like local elections, the importance of city council members, the importance of mayoral elections on a very like deeply local level in terms of getting access to language, resources, and public funding. And so, yeah, ultimately it was, I would say, when I came back to New York in 2021, that's when I got most actively involved.
Sorry, I just want to check in on this side of the room. Are you guys hearing okay? Do you need folks to speak up at all? You good? Thumbs up? Okay. Just making sure. Sorry.
Similarly to Angela, I was mobilized to vote my first time in a local election. I'm originally from, so Those local elections are very important. Grown up in a family that is very civically engaged. I grew up watching presidential debates on TV, very angry, I guess, and having discussions with my family members about what I could do, how I could get involved. And I think all of that also developed as a counter to a lot of fellow students in my school in Houston that had differing views, so that's kind of my background with voting. And then my next election after that was the 2020 presidential race as well. So for sure, seeing what happened in 2016, that helped me get more involved from an early age. My first chance to vote, I did elections, and then I continued on in 2020.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah, it sounds like all of y'all felt really empowered at a young age, and some of you discussed, you know, feeling really agitated by the state of the world at the time. Robbie, thank you for sharing about how crucial it was to have MCN in your life to give you the opportunity to civically engage. Yeah, I remember when my first couple of elections as well, I would always post the photo of me turning it into my little mail-in ballot and saying, like, hey, everybody, make sure you also do this. You know, so it sounds like we're all on the same page as very early on wanting to encourage our peers to get involved. We'll go ahead and go on to the next question now. So you all work with different Asian American communities throughout the city. And so I'd love to hear you pull from your own work experience and also lived experience on answering this question. What barriers have our families and communities encountered when becoming civically engaged? Does anyone want to kick us off? Helen, go ahead.
I can speak to the communities that I've grown up in and among the youth that I work with at AFI, Asian American Spirituality. I think even though I was in a family that had similar political views to me, I would see among the immigrant community a lot of misinformation and sometimes sort of an echo chamber beliefs that they espoused. One, I think, cause of this that occurred later on was the emergence of WeChat and how often WeChat is used in Chinese communities in the U.S. and abroad. So I definitely have seen a rise in, I think, more extreme beliefs in some immigrant communities that my family takes part in. So that's just one, I think, barrier that I've seen. There's misinformation, lack of fact-checking, I think, in some news and how it spreads. Language definitely plays a role in this. A lot of major news outlets are not available in Chinese language, so the sources that people end up using may not be entirely accurate. Secondly, among the youth that I see at my organization, there's, I think, a big range in how they access news. A lot of it is through social media. Thankfully, I think among youth there is still a little bit more social media literacy, so they know that what they see online is not always entirely true. They know how to double-check and use other news sources as well. But I think one issue that I see is sometimes the views of their family members back home may trickle down to them. So I know some of my youth are hesitant to engage themselves in civic engagement because their family members may warn them against it. I think sometimes it is because cultural trauma, they have experiences from their countries of origin that are, you know, very scary. Like, political engagement is not the same everywhere. I think we're still, in comparison, luckier to be in some protection for political speech. I think that's changing now, but some of our youth are hesitant of what they've heard.
And I would love to kind of continue what Helen's talking about
well, the fear that my community or my family might have towards political, you know, engagement, but also, you know, fear is one thing, and then also this delayed feedback loop that keeps you frustrated, as if, why isn't my vote doing anything? What do I mean by both of these things? So my family, you know, my parents were born and raised in Afghanistan, Pakistan for a few years. And these are both countries where, you know, a peaceful transition to power, which is a social norm here in America that is, you know, being highly contested. But historically, you expect at an inauguration, the president, the ex-president's going to show up. There's going to be a peaceful transition. And there's collaboration, regardless of party lines. That's not usually a norm. Bribery, corruption, these are things that, you know, my parents and my family speak about. There's this idea that maybe not, the issue is not if we want to be involved in governance, but we're scared that this government or this governance is going to be the majority of our life. Are we giving them too much power versus wielding power how we kind of are convening today? So that has really, you know, shaped how my family and my community looks at voting. And with the most recent election, I mean, you can hear from Latin Americans all across the country and anecdotal evidence that they were scared that they would be retaliated or, you know, that they would be unlawfully targeted because of who they voted for. The second part, which is this delayed feedback loop. I mean, we live in a country, and as we just answered, we mentioned presidential elections. Presidential elections are still, I believe, the election that many people associate with voting versus their local state senators or maybe congresspeople, maybe assembly members, who I believe have more tangible impact on their local lives. So zoning or education or you know, tax policy, whatever it may be. That's still what people assume voting to be. And, you know, if I vote for a president and I don't see tangible action on the local level, I get frustrated. There's this feedback loop, and that can cause individuals not to vote anymore. But the anchor that I see is community. This is proven by data, and it's proven by anecdotal evidence that if the younger that you start voting, the more likelier you are to continue voting. But if your elected officials are not delivering on their promises, you're more likely to move away from it and maybe look to other ways to make impact in your community.
Adding to what both said, just taking even a step further, I think within my community, I also organize with a lot of Fujianese Americans. So Fujianese are one of the largest undocumented population of Chinese American city. So there is a huge gap between the first generation of immigrants who don't speak English, are working restaurant, garment, factory jobs, and the second generation who are slowly assimilating and being told that to focus on that assimilation, right? Be a part of the American fabric. A large part of that is like not understanding the importance of voting as being essential. It is additional accessory that like folks can choose to engage, or it's a privilege to some folks to be able to like take time off work and go to the polls. And a lot of that is also coming from the mindset of not seeing themselves reflected in our American communities and government. And so a lot of that thought process then is passed down to the second, third generation. My mom became a citizen when I was 22 years old. And some of the first things we did together was actually take her to the poll site. Me taking time off work to like walk her to poll site, help her understand what was going on in our local elections, and allowing her to inform, kind of have a better sense of what, who she was voting for and what policies and issues that were on the ballot. I mean, it's interesting that what Helen brought up about the WeChat misinformation. My mom is very susceptible to WeChat information, but I'd rather her have the muscle of actually going to the polls and voting at the very least, right? So it's like, let me cross that gap first. And then there's, of course, another gap of like making sure that she has access to information. But I think with voting and civic engagement, we really have to start from the beginning with some of our community members, right? And not make assumptions that folks know exactly who or what they're voting for, right? Or that they have access to this information. You know, me and my mom have voted very differently across actually the most recent presidential election, but that doesn't stop us from having those conversations. I'm glad that we're able to engage in them. I think in addition to voting, what really supplements our open community conversations in which we interrogate and feel comfortable with discussing what's on the ballot too as well.
Yeah. Thank you all for sharing, hearing a lot about some of these, you know, structural barriers like language access, but also a lot of like mental, emotional barriers for our community members to have to overcome in order to get to the ballots and then also be able to evaluate these political issues with I'm sorry, to be properly informed. So we're going to go ahead and move on to the next question. For panelists who work directly with youth, how are they civically engaged? And for our panelists who do work directly with youth, if you want to say a bit about what your role at your organization looks like and what your relationship to your youth is, I think that could be helpful to contextualize things for folks.
So currently I work as a youth counselor and workforce readiness coordinator. In some of the ways that I engage with youth about how they are involved civically is actually through our internships at our organization. So, it's also through APA Voice. So I've been lucky to work with youth who are very involved civically, who want to learn more about that process and are not afraid to jump in even though they don't have a very strong breadth of knowledge at first. So some of the work that those youth have done is canvassing, tabling to make sure that their community members are better informed and can access that kind of education. And then I think I've been very happy to see that a lot of youth, even the youth that they are reaching out to, are willing to participate in that education, to get registered to vote, and to have discussions even when they may not feel super comfortable talking about it at first. I think youth are very willing to get involved and to learn more about how they can improve their communities and make an impact. But overall, I'm still seeing, a missing piece of who is doing that political education, how many youth are being reached out to. I can talk more about different ways that they can get involved. Initiatives that are in place in state government that will be addressed.
Thank you for that, Helen. In the context of how I engage with youth today, it's really, I'm a project manager at my career center at John Jay College, CUNY. So John Jay College is one of the CUNY campuses. CUNY is the largest public university system in the country. And we serve, we're tasked with serving 11,000 students that come from very diverse backgrounds, different socioeconomic situations. We're tasked with guiding them, supporting them, and gaining outcomes for them in this very ever so competitive job market. And so how they become civically engaged is in ways that they don't even realize. It's when they're searching for a job, they're worried about their wages, they're worried about the risks that this job may hold. And how does this relate to civic engagement? Well, historically, historically, work and having a job is seen as one of the main ways, if not the way, that you are most engaged in civil society. So you're a restaurant worker, you have an establishment, or you work for a company or in a leadership position, you employ millions of people, whatever it may be. So young people are mostly seeing that when they look at the job market, wages are not keeping up with the cost of living in a city. Things are not matching up. And we see this with our elected officials, specifically the mayor, the current mayor. He kind of highlighted this. So they're worried about wages and the quality of the jobs that they're going to have in the future. They can't control those macroeconomic factors. You know, they can't control things like, you know, what's a competitive job or why is this competitive, but they can control maybe who they vote for kind of hears them and supports a federal minimum wage or supports increasing the federal minimum wage, supports stipend programs for young high schoolers so they get more work experience. The second part, which they're incredibly worried about, is kind of artificial intelligence and AI. I apologize if this is like the 10th time you guys are hearing this, if you usually, you know, attend conferences. But, you know, Anthropic, who owns Claude, rivaling ChatGPT and OpenAI, I mean, their CFO said 90% of the code that they have in their company, which is, projected to be a $1 trillion company, is AI. It's automated by artificial intelligence. What is this going to mean for the mid-sized companies, the downstream effects, the companies that employ these young students and these young graduates who want to attend college for 4 years, spend those 4 years, want to get a better job. So they're really worried about this. And this pushes them to litmus test these candidates, these local state senators. How are you going to help me in 5, 10 years when I have to provide for my family? I have to, you know, have rent and food on the table and et cetera. So they're engaging whether they realize it or not. And the truth is, labor and work, it touches all of us in our civic life. And so I'm optimistic about their engagement in the next 5 years because they're so pessimistic about what the future holds. And sometimes that's the perfect combination for true activism.
I have a little bit of an abstract answer, but I think I was first compelled to engage as like a high school intern at OCA's New York Crimes Prevention Art Project. It's still a running program to this date. We've been hosting it for over 20 years, but that propelled me to go to UCLA and pursue Asian American as one of my degrees. At UCLA, I was learning about the Third World Liberation Front, the organizing in the 60s, the UCSF strikes, and all that stuff. And I think when you learn about all these incredible moments in history, I think you forget that you are also living in an incredible moment in history. To be able to connect, I think, what was past to what's going on in the present, I think right now where, like, our democracy is at stake, where workers, there's, like, labor struggles and workers' rights are also at stake, I think we forget that we, similar to the giants that came from history, like, we are in a point in history where we can make change, right? And that really stems from civic engagement. And kind of just tie this all together, I think education is a really important tool set in kind of connecting the dots for young people, because you never know what it is that they will draw from those learnings, whether it is about hate crimes, right, whether it is about the labor strikes, whether it is about the Japanese internment or the Chinese exclusion. All those are such critical skill sets, and that's also why I think OCA was so keen on helping found Read the Reach Coalition, which is the coalition advocating for Asian American Studies curriculum to be taught in K-12 schools. And this is why we're so super excited to be working with folks like Ari that are directly at the forefront of this work. So wrapping it all up, I think education is super key. And I think with OCA, we've been really involved in some of the continuing and sustaining our youth education programs like the Hate Crimes Prevention Art Project.
Thank you, everybody, for sharing. What I'm hearing y'all touch on is this idea of political agitation and the importance of political agitation amongst our young people, right? A lot of the times when these social movements form, they don't know at the time that they're going to make history, you know? They just think, how am I going to improve my conditions? What do I need to look better for my life, for my community, for my people? I think as youth workers, we get to meet these folks at such a crucial intervention time when we can awaken that consciousness and say, hey, we don't have to accept these conditions that we have them as they are now. We can actually strive for something better. I think as youth workers, we can put in those dreams and optimism into our folks and give them tools and pathways to leadership to really make that vision, those hopes, a reality. Yeah, I think there's a... Oh, Angela, do you want to...
I just want to add to that. And youth have the energy, right? I don't think folks, my mom in her 60s, will be going out canvassing. I think we need to be harnessing that energy, and it's really important for organizations like AFI and APA Voice are directly working with youth, because that energy is so incredible, and I think also youth have the courage and the energy to, like, dream and imagine something better. And so that's something I think people were, like, underselling. Incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I love, Angela, that you brought up the Third World Liberation Front. There's this saying that's like, you have no history, no self. If you don't know your history, you don't know yourself. You don't know where you've been. You don't know where you can go. So I have one last question before I open it up for Q&A. So get your questions ready if y'all have them. And the last question is, what urgency do you feel around empowering young people to be civically engaged voters in this particular moment?
Um, This is a great question. When I was thinking about what I wanted to say at this panel and kind of share with you guys here, I came across this question and I was like, we all know this time is urgent and it's more polarized than ever, but what can we define it as? I just see what's happening like in my society right now. In my lifetime, which, you know, I was in high school when the 2016 election happened, and since then we haven't had a two-term president. We've had, you know, insurrections and increase of political violence. It's very polarized and we can feel it. The urgent moment is a time where, you know, the United States Congress is the least productive than it's been in my lifetime. And trust in public institutions is the lowest than it's been in my lifetime. So we know it's an urgent moment, but where do young people kind of fit in this mold? Because it's so chaotic, there is a need for clarity, and there's a lot of flexibility and autonomy. I really urge young people to enter this space because of how chaotic it is. It's a great time to first of all interact with new people, to give your diverse, you know, voices, and kind of shape what this new era kind of looks like in the next 10, 20 years. I mean, my theory, my thesis is that, you know, for the past, you know, 40 years, the economic order has not met where the public wants it to be. And it's showing in our elected, you know, in our elected elections, and it's showing in our workplace and et cetera. There's going to be a next 40 years. And young people have the chance in this, you know, chaotic climate to draft or vision or have this idea of what they would like, you know, their families and their cities, their communities, their jobs, the world to really look like. What does, you know, the borough of Queens look like? Not as a 20, you know, someone that's lived there for 22 years, but for the next 22 years. So I do say it's incredibly urgent, but it's incredibly exciting too, to be very optimistic again about how pessimistic everyone feels, because I will say it again and again, it's a great combination for activism.
So one more slide. So now I think we've sort of created a good ground for paths forward. There are some new bills that are being introduced in state government right now. One is the Vote 17 Act, and the second one is the Student Voter Empowerment Act. So I can first talk about the Student Voter Empowerment Act. This has currently passed state Senate, but it still needs to be approved by Assembly before it moves on to the governor's desk. This bill would introduce a requirement for institutions of higher education that would require a staff member to create and implement a plan that would increase student voter engagement on campus. So this would mean registering students to vote, helping them make plans to vote and engage in their elections, and finally just generally help them democratically engage in their communities. So this sort of bill is really important right now. With everything that we've said, we know that young people right now are such an important nexus for their communities, and they're such an important way for the urgency and importance of civic engagement for our Asian American and Asian communities to engage in. There is a lot of potential, I think, for this bill to really change the ground in which we're working right now. I spoke earlier about how youth right now are really ready and willing to engage civically, but not all of them are being reached out to, or they may not know exactly where to start. So having this sort of engagement on their college and university campuses is such a great opportunity for them moving forward. The second bill I wanted to speak about was the Vote 17 bill, which would allow 17-year-olds who are about to turn 18 before their general elections to vote in those primary elections beforehand. This one is still early on in the approval process in government, but this would also be such a game changer. It would allow young people who are currently in high school to engage much earlier in their elections than we otherwise would see. I only work with high schoolers right now, and I see a lot of enthusiasm for voting. There's a lot of pre-registering happening, but they can't engage until they actually turn 18. So this bill would also be a wonderful addition. And you can contact your local representatives and state representatives to help make this happen as well.
I think the, another key component, and just adding on to what Helen shared, is that I think a lot of young people are also living in multi-generational households. They are maybe the only folks in their family that speak English. And so as such, they hold such key important roles in both informing their parents, the elders, about things that are going on. The 2030 census is a super critical component of that. The census is super important because it determines who represents us, who gets funding, how districts are divided to leverage political power. And so, unfortunately, this year's, the 2030 census, it's only going to be English, in English, which means that we need to make sure that our young people are talking with their elders, their community members, working with community organizations to make sure that everyone is filling out the census, because that is going to determine the kind of the needle on political strategy for the next 10 years. So please, please register and help folks know about the census.
So we have a QR code up here that y'all can scan or put in that that link there to commit to completing the 2030 census. I know it's far, but it's important for it to be on our radars really early so we can make sure our community is counted. And that might take some additional encouragement because of the barrier of it being in English. But that's what we are here for. I also want to take a moment to plug our APA Voice LEAD program. Yes, so Helen mentioned some opportunities for youth to get involved, and APA Voice, which is, as some of y'all may know, a coalition of Asian American orgs, APA orgs, who really are dedicated to increasing civic engagement and participation amongst APA folks in New York. We, as a youth working group, are launching our first college program, the Leadership Education Advocacy and Development Program, where we'll be pulling in any young people who are currently attending a college in New York City to come in and receive one-on-one mentorship with lovely industry professionals, like much like these folks. Helen will be one of the mentors, and they'll learn how to do things like Canvas and advocate at Albany, and you know, phone bank and organize all these things. We're looking for Asian American leaders already on their communities to help and basically try to implement the things that the Student Voter Empowerment Act is trying to do. So if y'all know any young Asian people or young people in general, they don't have to be Asian, who would be interested in applying or you think would benefit from this opportunity, highly encourage you to pick up a flyer on your way out. Would appreciate you circulating. So, yes. And we also have a lot of APA Voice swag and voter registration forms over here at the table where Rebecca is sitting. Rebecca's waving. So please stop by, have a chat with us. We'd love to speak with you one-on-one. And those are all of our planned questions for now. So I want to open it up to the room for any questions that y'all may have for our panelists. Yes. Do you want to go ahead and say your name, friend?
Oh, yeah. Hi. My name is Reed. I'm a high school senior at Nevada High School. I was wondering, kind of beyond, like, voting statistics or, like, election wins, like, how you measure success in your role and kind of what that looks like, what you look for, and kind of, like, what qualifications you use to measure progress.
Do you mind repeating the first part of the question?
Yeah, I think, like, beyond, like, voting statistics or, like, wins in elections, like, how do you measure, like, progress and success in your roles?
I think, Ryu, by the virtue that you are also in this room with me and we're discussing this, is a measure of success. Ryu is an OCA New York Hate Crimes Prevention Art Contest intern, and then I was also an intern 10 years ago. Even though it's a small program, every year we host 15 students. the students then go out to be leaders in their own communities. And so for us, a lot of that success is qualitative. We are hearing stories of students starting their first nonprofit organization or engaging in conversations or being leaders, such as yourself in this classroom. And so, yeah, that is one measure for us.
Yeah, I think along those same lines, I would just say that even seeing students moving beyond that hesitancy to engage politically in their communities is a huge win, because if you start there, it's a ripple effect. They start to speak to their peers, their family members, and overall just helps to increase their political engagement as well. And then I think youth are also such an untapped portion of our, I guess, political voting blocks, as we learned earlier. So the more youth we engage, the more our numbers begin to reflect in election outcomes, as we've already seen movement in.
And for me, I'm kind of speaking outside of, you know, they have roles that are more directly with youth and in bolstering civic engagement. I'm someone that, you know, am interested in politics, policy, law, what that means in the future. I think the outcomes, elections are the most visible outcomes, whether or not you win or you lose. But the truth is, the work that we do is coalition building, and it's more of a long-term game than anything. There's a lot in the media about the far right and its media ecosystem and how, you know, the progressive media needs to combat it. And these are the coalition partners that takes a very long time to build. And if you center on retention, like I was saying, you're an intern, now you're a leader, now you're an alumni, et cetera. It's really just keeping in contact with all these people that you meet and develop, and making sure they pay it back forward, because they're most visibly going to show up in election time. But this kind of work, it precedes a single president, it precedes a single congressperson, or et cetera. It's a vision of what this world, you know, can be, and it's multiple coalitions. That's very long term.
Since we have a bit of time, I can also chime in real quick on this. I think as a youth worker, thank you for your question. Some of the biggest success stories that I have is when my students talk to me and they say, I feel more confident about my politics, and I can actually talk to my parents now. And I feel confident intervening in political conversations because we've practiced having them. And I think that confidence is also a big measure of success. So thank you for your question. Yes.
My question is more about attitude. As we all know, immigrants come to the U.S. with notions of politics from the home country, entrenched ideas often that are often negative, right? And so that's part of the reason immigrants don't engage. There's less civic engagement. And then they pass on these ideas to their children, or rather they do not encourage their children to be a part of the civic engagement process. So my question is about, how do you battle that? How do you address that?
Well, I love to start this one because, you know, for reference, I'm 22. I'm going to walk the aisle, fingers crossed, with my graduate degree. I mean, my undergraduate degree. My mother, again, she's Afghan, born and raised in Afghanistan, and doesn't have more than maybe, you know, middle school education. Politics to her, as we talked about in the beginning of panel, was dangerous, because it's not only risky for the prime minister or their secretary, it's risky for activists. It's risky for people that want to speak out to the systems of power or want to enter the system of power and then play the game of politics. So for her, for the past 4 years, she's always been trying to figure out what I'm doing, and also want to make sure that I'm not going a little crazy in the sense, like, she doesn't want to see me at a protest in handcuffs or talk about things that might, you know, get on the news in a wrong way. So her attitude change was truly the small little things that I see now personally. Anything that I want to share with her that is a little bit difficult for me to convey in my language, and she's a very smart woman. She speaks Pashto, Farsi, Urdu. She speaks three languages. She understands English pretty well. What I do is whatever I want to say in English, I put it in Google Translate. I get the Urdu narration. I put it text-to-speech, and she hears it. And it's like this mother tongue that she's learning, and her eyes gleam, and she understands it a little bit. And it's a mix of her lived experience knowing America is different, knowing America has provided me a degree, has allowed me to be educated and meet with scholars and researchers of institutions I can only imagine that have lifted us out of, you know, of a socioeconomic situation. She understands the country's different. Maybe politics might has some same similarities. So I try and bridge the gap where I can. And something that I love, again, representation. Having a mayor that speaks Urdu and maybe had, you know, certain songs at his election that these immigrants hear and they're like, I didn't know that was even possible. You know, for him to have conversation with voters very visibly in Urdu and have them understand it, all of this is kind of, the more that you can show that very visibly to your parents and the attitudes, I wish I could have brought her here and maybe she could see what I'm doing. I can't really explain what a panel is. And she's like, why are you, like, I'm so confused. A conference, what is that, you know? So the more visible I am to her, the more I try and bridge that gap, the more excited she becomes about what's in for me and the less uncomfortable she becomes about the future. That's for me at least.
I think as I start growing older, I realize that a lot of what I thought were like taboos in me and my parents' relationships were actually just not. Like, there was just no discussion about it, right? Growing up, I didn't have dinner table conversations about politics. But now, like, coming back home and talking to my parents, my mom actually loves talking about politics. I think it's like misunderstanding silence or lack thereof as like taboo, and these are not topics that we actually want to engage in. And again, that's really cultural language barriers. And this is actually where, similarly, I actually applaud AI and like Google Translate. Those features are actually super duper helpful. I, as like the oldest daughter, like I actually can speak some of like my mother tongue. But my siblings, who are 5 years younger, they can't communicate with my parents at all. And for the longest time, I served as like the intermediary translator between my siblings and my parents. But now Apple has this tool where you just click on the text and it automatically translates into whatever language you have your phone set in. And so my parents are able to communicate with my siblings through emojis, through text, and that's just open ways in which that we haven't weren't able to see before, also purely because 10 years ago that feature wasn't accessible. So yeah, I think all that to say, another big part is like challenge what's hasn't been said, right? Like, don't mistake silence for complacency, right? Don't mistake silence for like not wanting to have those conversations. Sometimes they do, and it just needs a little bit more of prodding and work, right? I think the other aspect is there is a very real fear of like what talking about politics can do in this moment, in this time. I have students, interns coming to me and saying that they are fearful about their involvements on campuses. And these students are also on campuses that are heavily targeted because they're Ivy League institutions. And so they've retreated to the background because they are scared for both them and their families who don't have status. And so to that aspect, that's where I urge folks to think about what it means to be in coalition, right? What it means to stand in solidarity with other community members that might not share the same ethnicity or background as you, but the values are there, right? What it means to work again, like interracially across different coalitions and really build something that is beyond just beyond yourself, something that's bigger than yourself.
We've both spoken so well on this topic already. I don't have a lot to add. I'll just say that just building on that point about the importance of being in coalition with one another, the power that comes with that, it also is so important for us to contribute to community-based organizations, other nonprofit organizations who are specifically trying to serve those communities that are feeling a lot of mistrust towards political involvement. Youth are a really big part of that, and engaging in these organizations and building upon that trust that we can build with immigrant communities is very important. I've already seen the work that Ming Kwan and other members of APA Voice have been doing in creating nonpartisan voting guides in like 5+ languages representing a lot of Asian Pacific Islander communities. And I think that sort of work is so critical, but it doesn't have the impact that it could have if those targeted members in the community can't access it, or they don't have stakeholders in their families, in their communities, who are encouraging them to read those flyers, read those pamphlets that we are distributing. So that's just one little addition to what has been said already.
Thank you all so much for your insightful answers and your wonderful questions. In the next 4 minutes of our time together, I want to encourage you again to come by our table, pick up some forms, and chat with us.